This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, welcome to CarCast Plus Edmonds, our CarCast of Edmonds podcast. I'm Matt, the moderator, DeAndre, here with Alistair Weaver, editor-in-chief, Edmonds.com. I think people are going to start figuring that out eventually, that you're editor-in-chief of Edmonds.com.
It's a long title. In fact, that's not my full title, but it makes for a lengthy business card. How are you, Matt?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Not too bad. Shorter week this week, heading for a little family vacation.
Yeah, that's right. Labor Day is coming up. I forget about the holidays because just so much of what I do is kind of work from home and freelance and, you know, doing podcasts and a beverage company that I kind of forget holidays exist.
It just means you need to cram 5 days work into four.
Yeah, it's kind of what it means. Yeah, or it means I'm going to leave town and then work on the road or do something on the road. But for you, that usually means what? It means you pack up the family and you try to convince them they're going on vacation, but really you're just testing another vehicle.
So something like that. But it's really like in my job, I have a very privileged position that I can call upon like a fleet of vehicles that Edmonds owns or Edmonds runs, but also test cars that we have in, and we get through about 300 a year or so. But it's like, it's kind of the kids get used to, what car we're going in, Dada, and they love trucks. They absolutely, there's something about, you know, despite being a Brit with a French wife.
I was going to say, your babies are American. Your kids
babies
are American,
and they love trucks.
Yeah.
I brought a Raptor R home the other week, and like the excitement on my 4-year-old's face was just amazing. So I don't know. There must be something in like human psychology that just a really loud V8 and a massive truck does important things to you.
Listen, the feeling that we get at 4-year-old with that truck is the same we get at 44-year-old with that truck. So yeah. I get it. It doesn't go away. It doesn't go away.
And it's something that can't be taught and is instinctive, which I love. But anyway, this time it was like, put the money where the mouth is. So we're going to take the Rivian truck, which Edmonds owns as part of, we buy cars as part of our fleet. We talked about this before on the show. We've done about 14,000 miles in it since we had it. And we were one of the first people to actually get a Rivian in the US. And I was like, right, we love the truck. It's going to be, you know, great for heading up the coast. But of course, then you've got to build in this range anxiety. And it's less about the range anxiety on the truck, which will do like 250, 300 miles realistically, heading up the highway. It's more about like, will the infrastructure work when I get there? And it's going to be hot. I've got kids in the back. I've got a wife who is understandably going to be less than chuffed if we have to queue for a charger and then sit there for an hour. So all these factors just create a sense of stress that wouldn't exist if I'd taken even the Jeep Cherokee, which is plug-in hybrid. You know, this simply wouldn't exist. But, you know, you got to put your money where your mouth is and kind of like experience it a little bit.
So let me ask you, why? why grab the Rivian for the family road trip? You're just trying to throw some obstacles, a little challenge. I mean, I get it. It's a cool vehicle. But as you said, you have access to a fleet of vehicles. Why pick the Rivian?
Okay, two reasons. One, it's a cool truck. Secondly, most of the vehicles that we now own are EVs because we're heavily focused on EVs. And thirdly, like, I actually wanted to experience it for real because this is kind of the job. And, you know, one of the probably you've got to get out there and experience. And this is I'm going from LA to Monterey.
Yeah.
So just basically heading up the coast and either the 5 or the 101. So this is like a classic Californian journey, LA to San Francisco. So the infrastructure is pretty good along the road. But you've still got to, you know, you've still got to piece it together. I mean, in theory, I've only got to stop once. And, you know, you've got kids, so you've got to stop. So it shouldn't be a drama. You know, you'll stop, the kids will run around, you'll have a pee, and you'll get back in the car.
So, yes. Okay, so first of all, the term that keeps coming up again and again and makes sense is more charging anxiety and less range anxiety. You know, because we're so worried about like where we're going to charge. Is it going to be broken? Is it going to work? How long is it going to take? Is it got enough power? And is it quick? Is it slow? It's like, you know, what does it cost? Is it free? Like there's a lot of charging questions. You know, so I guess the range anxiety part of it is, can I make the trip in one shot or not? So I don't know. It sounds like you're going to drive about 300 miles. How much range?
Yeah, I can't do it in one hit.
You can't.
I can't do it one hit.
What is the range of the Rivian? So which Rivian did you get? And like, what's the battery size, the spec? Like, let's start with
that. So this is the R1T launch edition, which has the bigger battery.
So it's the pickup truck basically, with the big battery.
It's the pickup truck with the big battery. And EPA says 314 miles. We did the Edmunds EV range test, which basically takes you on a route around Southern California, which is a mix of driving, and we achieved 321 miles. So we marginally beat the EPA, which typically we do. So, of course, you don't run it. We're going to juice it up at home. So it's going to stuff it full of electrons. But of course, you don't run it to zero. And, you know, you're going to want to give yourself 50 miles or whatever, in the same way that you fill up in your gas car when you, you know, when the tank's a quarter full or whatever. So realistically, we're going to go 200, 250, 250 miles most. And then we're going to be looking for a charger. So the Rivian, when you, like most EVs now, you go into the vehicle, and you can even do this in the app on your phone, and it will basically plot out the route and say, okay, charge for 20 minutes here at this 350 charger, then drive for another hour and a half and charge for 10 minutes here. And that's the most efficient way of getting to your destination.
Okay.
And that's fine, as long as the chargers aren't busy when you get there and as long as they work. And at the weekend, I went to my local fast charger, which is like all of a mile from where I live, pulled in the truck, and just by chance, another Rivian and R1S pulled in alongside me. Neither of us could get the charger to work. And then other people start having problems as well. So I think there's about 8 different chargers there. And I had to go through about 3 or 4 to actually get one that would work. And I was about to give up, and eventually it worked. Now, that's a mile from my house and I can charge at home. But on the road trip, like, it's got to work.
It's got to work. Is once you get to the destination, wherever you're staying in Monterey, is there a charging station there, like at the hotel or something? Can you charge the vehicle there, or do you have to leave the hotel and find another charger?
I need to call them and check, actually. I mean, most hotels now, or sort of more upmarket hotels, should we say, have charging. But then you also get into the broader conversation about the Rivian, which is, it's a big, heavy truck. And it's actually, I was going to say the truck was the least efficient vehicle we've ever tested. But actually, that's not true, because it was recently beaten by the R1S, which is the SUV version of the Rivian. But to give you some sort of context, it uses twice as much juice as a Tesla Model 3.
Right.
So in simple terms, you can say that it's going to take twice as long to charge. It's not quite as straightforward as that, because it's all to do with how the software and the hardware works to charge the vehicle. So it's simplifying it a little bit. But in general terms, it's going to take twice as long as your Tesla to charge. And if you feel, I mean, that's no different to a gas car, right? If you have a Mustang versus a Prius or something, it's going to take twice as long to fuel up the Mustang for the same number of miles. But if it's 2 minutes versus 4 minutes, who cares? If it's 20 minutes versus 40 minutes or 40 minutes versus 60 minutes, then that makes a big difference.
Yeah, it does. Right. Have you guys seen any improvements to that process since owning the Rivian? Has there been any updates, any over-the-air updates? It's not going to just be a software issue because of the size of the battery. It's got a massive battery, but has there been any ways to make that better?
I mean, we're just doing an engine of partnership to test charging speed. So there isn't a normal way of measuring charging speed at the moment. Like how long are you going to sit there waiting for it to charge? Because what people tend to do, sorry, long-winded answer, but I'll get that. What people tend to do is quote something that makes them look good. So they'll either quote like 10 to 90, 20 to 80%, 30 to 70, or a peak charging speed or whatever it may be. But we're actually going to go out and analyze like how all these vehicles work and how, you know, because charging speed differs dramatically from vehicle to vehicle. And they can adjust it with over-the-air updates. So, you know, but what you've got in the case of my experience at the weekend, I don't believe it was actually a Rivian issue. It was actually I think it's probably more likely an EVgo issue because other people were struggling as well. So you've got this feeling like you have this moment when you plug in where the technology in the car has to mesh with the technology in the charger. And then at some point, you know, it all turns green and you're charging. But there is that innate stress in, will this work?
Right. So when I was up in Monterey and I was talking with Jim Farley from Ford, he had just done a road trip in a Ford Lightning. He didn't drive across the country, but he flew into San Francisco and drove from San Francisco down to LA to Orange County and back up and around. Like, he spent a couple days and made a bunch of stops and Ford dealers and customers and whatever. And when I sat down with him, I said, you know, tell me a little bit about your experience with driving the Lightning, doing your road trip, because I have a Lightning as well. And although I mostly charge it here in my warehouse, I do occasionally charge it at a public station. And my experience is it is not pleasant. It is a bit of a mess. It's hit or miss. You think that there's a, you know, one charger open in a line of five chargers, and you realize that one's open because somebody ran over the plug so many times that the plug is smashed and it won't attach to a vehicle or it won't charge. And the apps and stuff are not always completely accurate. It says there's a charger open, but it doesn't know that the plug is smashed. So it's forever open. But, you know, so it's kind of like, oh, do you roll into you look on your app or you look on the vehicle and you're like, here's a charging station with five chargers. One of them is open. To me, I think that one is broken. If I don't see at least two open, then I'm like, it's because it's broken. So I don't even register. I'm like, I'm not going, oh, I'm going to go get the one. If I hurry, I can beat the next Tesla there. No, I just assume it's broken. If there's not at least two available, then I'm not even going to stop. And talking to Jim about it, he basically, again, he brought up the term charge anxiety. He goes, yes, you get this charge anxiety. Is it going to work? Is the charging station open? Can you access the charger? Like we were just saying, I might find a charger that pops up in a parking lot nearby, but it's in a lot with a gate and it's in, you know, it's behind like a Marriott, you know, valet, and I can't get to it unless I'm staying at the hotel. So it popped up on my phone, but it's not something I can get to, right? Which happened to me like down in Irvine. I was going to an event and I saw three charging stations in the area. One of them was in a parking garage, but it was for a corporate building that you can't access. There's a gate, you can't get to it. The other one was in a parking lot of a hotel, which you needed a key card to get to. I couldn't get it. And then the third one was one that I was able to get to, again, in a parking garage at a business complex. It just happened to have the gate open and I got to it and it worked. But not the ideal situation. It wasn't a clear indication of going, this is a public charger that you can access because it's not behind, you know, a gate of some sort, or it's in a shopping mall, or it's at the Grove, or it's in Santa Monica, or like, you know, like I don't, it is less than ideal. the whole task.
It is. And I thought the Farley thing was really interesting, because I actually bumped into him at Car Week as well. And he's, you know, this guy's the CEO of Ford. And one of the problems of being a CEO of Ford is you can just imagine that everything's private jet and chauffeurs and everything, because your time is so precious that you're, you know, the company wants you working, not driving.
Yeah.
And it's a hard, I thought it was a great exercise to actually go out there and, you know, experience it firsthand. And of all the big car bosses, actually, he's been probably the most, I hesitate to say honest, but probably the most open about the challenges and about the fact that if you're driving, you know, a couple of hundred miles, or you live in, you know, you live in an urban area, it's, and you can charge at home, then they make total sense and they have major benefits over internal combustion. But if you're living, you know, in a farm in Wyoming or whatever, and it's probably not the choice for you. So I think what he did and what he's been saying makes a lot of sense, especially as somebody who's at the forefront of, you know, trying to drive EV adoption. And I think I've spoken to a few sort of like senior execs within the industry, and I think it's all take them a long time to realize, and Porsche actually with the Taycan took a long time to get their heads around this as well, is that it's not about just building a product anymore. It's right. About the whole experience, and simply relying on third parties, EVgo, Electrify America, and everybody else to solve the problem or the state simply hasn't worked, which is why now we're seeing all the big OEMs club together to try and either set up their own infrastructure or get into bed with Tesla, whose system is way better and much more reliable, by the way, to try and access their infrastructure. Because they've realized, like, the biggest deterrent is not the vehicle. The biggest deterrent is now the infrastructure. The vehicle's actually fine, and probably 300 miles, and then you have like a 20, 30-minute charge. That's fine. It's just that, you know, as you say, too many are broken. They're in stupid places. You have to queue. And you have this kind of paranoia that it might not work. Then what happens?
Right, right. So you mentioned the Tesla thing. Yes, so many car companies are getting on board with being able to, you know, they partner with Tesla so they can start using Tesla chargers. And as that starts to roll out, that's not going to come without its fair share of problems, right? Like in certain areas, there's already a line of Teslas waiting to get charged. Now, if you're introducing all of these other companies, is this going to be a fast problem? Like it's going to be very quick. Like all of a sudden, you know, Fords and Chevys and stuff are going to start rolling out with Tesla plugs. And now good luck getting time at a Tesla charger. Or is Tesla going to be able to invest all this partnership money into more chargers fast enough that it may not be as painful? Seems like putting chargers in is going to be way more time consuming than signing a partnership deal and letting everyone else use your chargers.
Yeah, even with all the lawyers involved. If you look at it, Ford, I think, is going to have access to 12,000 of Tesla's. Tesla's got about 20,000 charged across the U.S. And it's about, I think it's like six, just over 60% of fast chargers in the U.S. are Tesla chargers at the moment. So Ford's got access to just over half of that. And then Tesla's saying we need to triple the number of superchargers that we have across the nation, but by 2030. So yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting. And the other part of that is, you know, the big reason to buy a Tesla was the infrastructure. And you're going to be mighty, mighty upset if you turn up in your Model 3 and somebody, you know, a Mach-E sat there, you know, plugged in, and then all the rest of it. So yeah, it's a bit of a mess. And, you know, they're now saying that, I think General Motors, Volvo, Polestar, Mercedes, they're all going to go to the Tesla charging system, which means a different plug. So it's almost like a, you and I are probably old enough to remember like VHS and Betamax. It's that kind of moment where probably everybody will normalize around the Tesla plug rather than the CCS plug, which is the one that you get on at the moment on every other EV. So you've got half the industry saying, we're going to go down the Tesla route and basically back Tesla to ramp their infrastructure fast enough. Then you've got another group, which is BMW, GM, Honda, Hyundai, Kia, Mercedes, Stellantis. And they're now basically saying, we're going to club together and create our own network of 30,000 fast chargers. Because I think they're basically saying, look, if we're serious about this and we're going to try and sell more EVs, we've got to solve this problem ourselves because nobody else is going to do it for us. Because at the moment you've got like, I think about 36,000 charging plugs in the fast charging plugs in the, you've got about 36,000. Let me get my facts right. About 36,000 fast charging plugs in the US, which is not a lot for 350 million people.
Right. Right. Yeah. Has anybody looked up how many gas stations we have? Because it seems to be everywhere. What is Mercedes' plan? Because it seems like, I don't know, 6 months ago, maybe it was a year ago, Mercedes, you know, hit us with a press release and all these fancy concept renderings of what looks like a super high-end Shell station, but it was Mercedes. And Mercedes going, we're going to start building out these like gas station like charging facilities, and they're going to be accessible to everyone. But if you have a Mercedes, you know, you pay less or it's included with the vehicle, and you can reserve a station and you can drive up and you just do it. And if you don't have a Mercedes, you can pay and you can still use it, but maybe you don't get the reservation, you wait in line. But Mercedes had this very optimistic plan of building out stations. Now you're saying, is that just a Mercedes thing, or is that part of their partnership with a bunch of other car companies?
So Mercedes seems to be having like a boot in each camp. So they're moving across to the Tesla based system so they can get access to Tesla chargers. But at the same time, they're also investing in this charging infrastructure with BMW, GM and Hyundai, Kia to build out, and Stellantis to build out their own infrastructure. So I think there's been a realization that nobody can really do this on their own unless you're Elon Musk. And so let's all get together and try and solve this. And so it's just going to take time. And I think you're going to have a few years of relative pain, which is a shame, because I think like as a product, the EVs are fantastic. We test all of them and they have so many advantages over a gas car, but you've got to get past this. And most people say, okay, it's all right, you charge at home. That's true. That's if you just generally, you know, it is all about, you know, if you are road tripping. And of course, in the US, it's a big country, people do tend to road trip.
Yeah, right. I think the car companies are realizing the amount of money it's costing to develop EVs, and not just the vehicle. Like you were saying with Porsche, it's like they were all focused on building the product and then kind of worried, didn't really worry much about how it was going to get charged, because that's somebody else's problem. And now it's all the car companies' problems, because nobody else is really kind of stepping up and solving the issue. I still haven't really figured out why, you know, all the oil companies, the Exxon Mobil, Shell's, 76s of the world aren't putting something together to have, you know, charging stations at as many gas stations and at least in the big areas as possible. And I'm sure franchises and ownership structures and all kinds of stuff with these gas stations that, you know, it seems like they'd be wanting to roll out some sort of plan, even if they partnered with a Tesla or, any of the other charging companies and go, listen, we have the real estate, right? And we've got proprietors who's running these stations, these gas stations. Let's partner up and, you know, like, hey, Shell. Shell's going to work with Tesla, as an example, to reach out to as many gas station owners, Shell gas station owners as possible, sell them the hardware and maybe the solar panels or whatever needed to put a charging station or two or three or four on site. And I just haven't heard much about that.
No, me neither. And I'm with you. You know, these are massive, massive, massive companies with which making tons of money. And you'd think they would be at the forefront of this. As you say, there's probably very good reasons why they're not. But if you're making your money not just from the gas, but also from people going in and buying, you know, one of those sausages that rotates for days on end,
yeah,
then then actually an EV makes more sense, because in a gas car, it's like, I'm done in 2 minutes, I pay at the pump, I'm gone. In an EV, you're parking up for like 20, 30 minutes waiting for it to charge. So you're almost like psychologically compelled to go and buy, you know, a chocolate bar, some jerky, whatever takes your fancy.
Right. Yeah. It seems like, especially the road trip ones, the ones, the huge rest stop gas stations with, you know, 30 pumps or whatever the big one is on the way to Vegas, they have like 50 pumps out there. It's like 50 pumps, but do they have any charging stations? I don't know. I never really stopped to look, but
there's a massive one at Baker. Yeah, there is, I think, on the way to Vegas. Yeah, there's, you know, it's coming, but it's, yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating business. And I guess we're just looking at it mainly from the consumer perspective of like, how do you navigate all of this?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's just a lot of education. You know, what is a level two? What is a level three? Well, a level two is your home charger. But, you know, you plug the Rivian into the charger I've got at home, which is actually a good system. And if the battery's flat, it's going to take like 30 hours to fully charge.
Yeah, it's a 20, lot.
Something to 30 hours, which is a long time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then you're onto the road and then it's okay. Now we're into a fast charge. So first thing you ought to work out is, what charger am I plugging into? So I'll give you an example which drives me nuts. LAX airport, you pull into the short-term parking and it's great. EV charging, great. It's like a level two charger like you have at home. So maybe you're going to like pick somebody up. You're going to be there half an hour. You plug it in, you're going to get 10 miles, 10, 15 miles, depending on what your vehicle is. Basically a waste of time. So you've got to work out like what charger is it. And then even with the fast chargers, is it 50, 150, 350? Well, if it's 50 kilowatts and you're in a truck or something, forget it. It's going to take too long. So you're looking for 150 or 350. Then you got to look at what your vehicle can actually handle. So a Lightning, for example, will only charge it up to 150 kilowatts. Put all that together. Get yourself signed up to four or five different charging companies. Plug yourself in. Hope it works. And then, you know, go from there. So there's this massive education piece that comes with EV ownership, which is just, you know, a lot to take on board.
Well, look, before you go on your road trip, you should take this podcast and let your wife listen to it and then let her decide if she's going on that road trip with you or not. this whole scenario sounds like it's the worst case scenario ever, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. I'm just saying,
no,
there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Charge up your truck before you leave home, have a couple of backup plans for charging on the way, and, you know, it'll be fine. It'll be fine.
I'm sounding super negative, and I don't mean, because I actually love EVs. And my wife has we have a Genesis GV60. We just swapped the Model 3 for the thing. She loves it, absolutely loves the EV, and we use it mainly. And it was kind of funny when we initially looked at getting an EV. This is our third EV. We've got a BMW i3 because we wanted it for the carpool lanes to commute. Then we got a Model 3. And then when we swapped the Model 3, we're kind of bored of the Tesla, so we got the Genesis, which is great. I remember my wife said back in the day, it was like, well, what if I want a road trip to Vegas?
Yeah.
And part of me was like, well, when was the last time you road trip to Vegas on your own without me? It's like, it doesn't, but it's the psychology of it, isn't it? It's like, but if I want to, how am I going to handle that?
Right. Right. I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and I was heading out to Vegas, and they said, are you going to take your truck, the Lightning? And I said, I just don't want to have to stop and charge it. And I mapped it out, and I was like, it's 285 miles door to door for me to leave my warehouse to get to the hotel. It was 285 miles. And, you know, my Lightning, they say 300 miles, doesn't get 300 miles. I think I get like 260, 265, you know, maybe closer to that 260 range on the low end, when I'm at just freeway speeds the whole time. And not only would I not make it, but there's also not enough room for like a little bit of a buffer. And I know you were saying it's your focus, your goal was more of like a 50 mile buffer, like, you know, at 50 miles of range left, you're really ready to stop. But for me, I was like, you know, at 15, 20 miles would been fine. So if I got realistically 300, 310 miles on a charge, I would go straight to Vegas. I got 285 miles to go. If I rolled into the hotel with 15 miles left on my battery, it's fine. If I could charge at the hotel, which I looked it up, you can, then I'd be okay. And then I would drive home. But you need a little bit of room, because especially like the Vegas run, if you come back on a Monday, it's a little safer than coming back on a Sunday, because everyone's coming back and all you need is one thing to happen and you're stuck in traffic and you're sitting there for an hour. And then how much battery is that going to take? And it's 115 degrees out and you got the air cranking, you know, so you, it's nice to have that 50 mile buffer, but you know, you could probably get away with 20 miles of buffer. And then, yeah, if you get really in a big traffic jam, you're probably going to have to stop for, you know, 20 minutes and get a little extra charge. But yeah, that's kind of prevented me from taking my Lightning to Vegas. Was I'd like to be able to do it in one trip, even if I didn't do it in one trip, but it'd be better to not stop.
See, the other thing, Matt, we haven't talked about yet is just the cost of fast charging. So there's a lot of rhetoric around EVs save you a bunch of money in fuel. And they do if you charge them at home in right. a kind of off peak and you set up your electricity usage deal to reflect the fact you've got an EV and charge it at the right time and stuff. Then you will save a ton of money. Maybe it'll be half as much as running equivalent gas car. But if you're using the fast chargers, they're pretty expensive. And one of my coworkers, Clint Simone, took the Rivian on a long trip. And I just got the details in front of me. He spent like $206 on electricity with a mix of Electrify America and EVgo, which he worked out at 22¢ per mile. Then he did a conversion that said, okay, if I'd done the same trip in a Toyota Tacoma, which is a slightly smaller trip, but similar sort of size, he reckoned it would have been 24 cents a mile. So you're only really saving 2 cents a mile, which, you know, it's a couple of bucks, isn't it? It's not really. And so that's also the thing that people have got to wrap their head around, that
yeah,
if you're going to rely on fast charging, you're not going to really save any money. It's depressing, this, isn't it?
Because public public charging is not cheap for the most part.
No.
Like, and if you're out here in LA and you live in an apartment complex and there is a charger in your garage, it's very likely that they're charging a premium for it and it's really slow. And then people want to leave their car there overnight, but then other tenants are like, hey man, there's only two of these things. And if you leave it overnight and you got a full charge after 6 hours, like what are you doing for another 4 hours, you know, just taking up space?
I went to the shopping mall and like somebody's like parked it up, off they've gone shopping, and it's like, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, right. I we're not quite there. Yeah, I charge in my warehouse here where I come to work, and you know, I've said this a number of times on the podcast, there's a line item on my bill where they're charging me more to offset the discounts at residential. There's no discount for a commercial. And I said, how can I monitor this and get a discount? And they said, you would have to have a meter installed just for the charger so we can just bill out that device. They said, otherwise, we have no way of getting you on like an EV program unless you had a dedicated meter here. And I was like, well, I've got plugs all over the place. I can't install a meter. Plus, I rent the warehouse. What am I going to do? Call the landlord and go, hey, let's get a meter in here. Let's start cutting up the walls. And that's not going to fly. So there wasn't really a scenario. So yeah, and it's still cheaper for me to charge in my warehouse than it would be throwing, you know, a credit card into the public stations, but not nearly as cheap as if I did it at home and got on the right program with, you know, whatever our utility company is out here.
Yeah. Yeah. Once you've paid the money to install it, you're off and running. But then there's all sorts of stuff like, have you got enough space in your fuse box? What's the Americanism for fuse box?
Yeah, well, here...
Breaker box.
Yeah, where the circuit
breaker. There you go. Still learning the language. Five years. Still learning the language. Yeah, have you got like a 50-amp breaker, which is probably what you need? So if you're running like an electric cooker and you've got a electric heater and stuff and it's all eating up your current, then you're going to need a dedicated breaker and stuff for your EV. So there's tons of stuff. The good thing is, I'm going to give you a little plug here. If you go to edmunds.com/EV, we actually have a ton of information which has been written specifically to kind of guide you through this process. So I don't want to sound like too negative. I feel like we spent half an hour bemoaning the system. You know, EVs are generally great, but
I like
you
driving
do need
my
to
truck.
Do your homework. You like driving your truck.
I do. I like driving my truck. I've been driving it for a while, and then I just grabbed the press car, which is super fun. I got the Toyota Supra, got the 3-liter, got the manual transmission. And it's fun to drive, but it's not fun to get in and out of. It's you realize, like, God, this car is small, and you have to like kick the door open as far as you can go just to kind of pour yourself, roll out into it. It was like, and I kind of forgot like what a tiny sports car was going to be like again. And as much fun as it is to drive, it takes the livability away. Now, I'm not saying that's the difference between gas and EV. I'm saying that's the difference between tiny sports car and massive F-150.
Maybe it's just an age thing, you know?
Yeah, maybe it's just an age thing. Although you were just looking into your coffee mug like someone was playing a joke on you. Like there's a dead bug in there, or a gummy bear, or a toy that one of your kids threw in there. You just looked at it with a look like, well, have I been drinking this the whole time?
this is actually a cup of English tea that I'm drinking. I've also been it's a gadget. It sounds like a plug, and I'm not an influencer being paid to say this, but I've got one of these Ember mugs, you know, ones that keeps you drink warm. Have you seen these things?
I trust you on it. I don't drink. This is a weird thing. I don't like drinking hot liquid. I don't drink coffee. I don't drink hot tea. It's like, I don't even get soup all that much, but it's just like, I'm just not down with the hot liquid.
But I like the idea. Like, you know, we're doing a show. It's an hour long. Yeah. You know, need a little pick me up. This mug will keep it warm for an hour. It's a genius invention. I wasn't even paid to say that.
Well, maybe Edmund should come out with coffee mugs
exactly.
For the road trip coffee mug. What else we got? What else is going on now that we just bashed the EV world or the charging network? There's got to be something more exciting.
And I'll come back next week and tell you that actually the whole thing was dead easy. Everything worked. Kids loved it. Had a great vacation. And
listen, I hope so. That's what it was. I hope that's what's going on.
It's not
earlier
a story,
this week,
but I hope it was.
Yeah. Listen, earlier this week, I talked with Goldberg on the podcast and told him I drove the $800,000 Gateway Bronco, which was super fun. All carbon fiber body, full-time all-wheel drive, ABS brakes, Coyote engine. $800,000 is a little rich for me, or everyone except for Post Malone, apparently, who ordered one. But really nice to drive, a lot of fun. $800,000 is a big number. They're selling them.
There's a guy around the corner that does beautiful conversions. They're about 100 grand. It's almost like a little pet project for him. And every time he trundles past him, I think I really want that. But 100 grand is still
yeah.
a
yeah. Well, drive the $800,000 one. I haven't driven the $100,000 one. For me now, it sounds like that's got to be the biggest hunk of garbage. The $100,000
just because it hasn't got a carbon fiber body.
Yeah, because that's it. But by the way, the non-carbon fiber body version of their trucks is $500,000. So, and they've had made a lot of revisions over the years that they've been making them, to the chassis, to the steering, to the handling, the suspension calibration, the exhaust note, like things that improve it over time that are kind of necessary versus building a one-off kind of hot rod. So anyway, that was kind of fun.
I'm at the risk of one-upmanship, Alpha this morning, as we're about to come on air, unveil the legendary 33 Stradale, which is an homage to the Tipo 33, which is probably one of the most beautiful cars ever made from the 1960s. If you don't know what that looks like, just Google Alfa Tipo, T-I-P-O 33. It's a stunning car. And they're going to build this. They're sort of getting into this sort of bespoke craftsmanship idea. They're gonna build... how many are they going to build? I think it's a very small... It's extreme. I think they're going to build 33.
I think they're going to be 33 of them, yeah.
They're going to build 33. Cute. They're going to be... They're all sold, apparently. So even before they've announced... Even before they revealed it, they're all being secretly sold to collectors. About just over $3 million. And you have a choice of either a 620 horsepower V6 twin turbo or a 750 horsepower electric powertrain. It'd be super interesting to see where people go, where like the residual values are and everything else. It looks incredible. And I saw the pictures without really realizing what it was. I thought, wow, that's sensational. And then I went, oh, but it's $33 million. And it's like, all right.
I've got thoughts on the engine. And I think this has maybe come up before on one of the other podcasts we've done. Collectability, these type of like supercars. And when you look at things like McLaren P1 and LaFerrari, and you hear about some of the battery issues, replacement batteries. Like I know someone's gone through, I think, 3 batteries in the LaFerrari, and, you know, warranty work on the LaFerrari and chargers not working. And it's because the cars aren't really, the batteries and stuff are not designed to just sit for months on end and then occasionally grab a weekend and go to Cars and Coffee or, you know, run an errand or something. Whereas we use most of our other EVs as daily drivers. So the idea of going, hey, here's a $3 million supercar, you're going to put it in your collection, you're going to not drive it at all or occasionally drive it. What happens to this big battery and, you know, that's in this thing? Because already we're sitting and taking all of our 12-volt batteries and put them on trickle chargers and still have to replace them. And well, what about a battery that's, you know, $500,000 on the bottom of a $3 million car? Like, what happens there? So I don't know that we figured that out yet. And I don't know that these companies are ready to step up with sort of warranty and you know, for the collector.
Yeah. I mean, the
like,
warranty
is there
is
a
typically
10
like
million
eight.
Or 20.
Yeah.
Is there a 10 year or 20 year warranty on the battery? Right. Which would solve the issue maybe as a collector. But my thought is these crazy supercars that are coming out, the hybrids and the, you know, and the EVs, I'm still down, not that I can afford any of it. I'm down with the gas engine version. If you said, order this Alpha, I go, I don't care how fast the electric version is. Give me the gas engine version. It's going to sound fantastic. It's going to make all the right noises. It's going to be plenty fast. And I think it's ultimately going to have the resale value compared to the EV version.
I'm going to place it, unless you've got a really rich collector who wants one of each, and that's entirely possible.
It is entirely
possible. Entirely possible at this level of market. I reckon they'll sell no EV versions.
You but really think
that's just a hunch for all the reasons that you've
But you don't think someone's going to go, hey, for $3 million, I want the 750 horsepower version versus the anemic 620 horsepower version with the gas engine?
The thing is, for $3 million, you can go to Pininfarina and get a 1,700 horsepower supercar.
Yeah.
But then you're probably buying both. I was talking to the Hennessy guys in, I can't remember if I said this last week, I was talking to the Hennessy guys up in Pebble Beach. And they were telling me that one of their customers had bought two, one to keep, $3 million each, one to keep as an investment, one to drive. I thought that's so cool.
It's funny because like even the Gateway Bronco guys, I said, how many Broncos have you sold? They said, like 150. And they go, well, how many of this new 800,000 horsepower, $800,000 one versus your $400,000 or $500,000? And he goes, well, we've only been announced it for the week since Monterey. We've already got 12 orders. And I think almost every, probably 10 of the 12 orders are from existing customers that already have the $500,000 one.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. You know, so why not? If you have the means, if you have $6 million and you want $2-3 million Alfa Romeos, God bless you.
Yeah, it does look, if you haven't seen it, Google it. It looks.
It is cool.
33 Stradale. It looks staggeringly beautiful. It's quite rare these days that you get a bit old and cynical. It's quite rare that something like jumps out on Instagram and you go, wow.
And it doesn't look quite like the supercars that we're seeing now. And there's a lot of similar kind of design features. I mean, I get it. It's still a car, right? It's got four wheels. It's got a swoopy nose and, you know, big side vents and stuff. And by the way, looking at this design with the big vents in the back that feed the gas engine, what do you think it looks like for the EV? Do they plug those things up? Do they go to different coolers, battery, differential? I wonder how they make that work. But as you said, each one of these is going to be a bespoke car. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
It's
I'm sure we'll never see one in person, so it's fine.
This is also, well, maybe at Monterey next year.
Yeah, maybe at the Quail next year.
it's a crazy thing. It's a fascinating thing about, you know, this whole market, you know, talking to Singer as well, you know, Singer has stopped making naturally aspirated cars. Well, they're still completing orders, but you can't order a naturally aspirated Singer. So suddenly your $400,000 investment now looks absolutely rock solid.
Right.
So it's just, I don't know. The only thing is like, I really love all the craziness of it all and everything else, but I just, you know, it's just a shame for me that, I mean, the Alphas, like, you know, their new car is the Tonale, which is like, okay, it's a small SUV. I don't think they'll sell many over here. It's too small, you know? And so it's like, yeah, it's a great image leader and a few rich people are going to buy and collect it and very nice, but come on, do something for like $50,000, $60,000 that, you know, the rest of us can buy.
Right. All they're saying is it's a terrible time to be poor. And meanwhile, the rest of us are like, you know, like my brother is shopping for a small SUV and there's a lot of good stuff out there. You know, he's not looking at a $3 million Alfa Romeo. He's looking at a $31,000, you know, SUV. Yeah. So we need to talk more about that as well.
I think next week we will do small SUVs.
Small SUVs. We need a buying guide.
More sensible consumer advice.
Yes. We need sort of the buying advice, the buying guide for the small SUV. I think that's an episode he's going to be looking forward to. All right. What do you say? We're going to wrap things up for today.
Sure. As I said, if you want to read more about all the EV stuff, edmunds.com/EV. There's a whole sort of buyer's guide, loads of stuff in there, which we put together, which is designed to answer all of these questions and, you know, take some, if not all of the heat out of it. So, and all our Rivian stuff is also up there as well about living with the Rivian. I think we've got 6 EVs in our long-term test fleet. I think that's right.
Yeah.
Everything from Ford Mach-E, a Lightning like Matt's, Lucid, Rivian, and all of them detail actually what these things are like to live with.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's the plug.
I'm definitely curious to get your download on the Rivian road trip experience. Not really just the charging infrastructure issues, but just spending that time in the Rivian. I mean, is the Rivian worth, you know, trading my Lightning in for at some point? I don't know.
Maybe. I think I'm going to do a few little videos as we go along. So not a full vacation. And maybe we can play those next week.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for listening. Until next week, keep the air and the spare in the bag and the wheel.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.